This is the SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a 2013 Hugo Award winner. Thanks to all of you listeners out there. And today we have a very special podcast. What I last time called a superstar panel, because basically it's a bunch of super awesome authors who have books out there and are really cool people, so I call them superstars. And this is going to be part two of our look at military sci-fi. And once again, I'm joined by the editor who was willing to take on an anthology that no one else would take on, but she won't do the sequel. Her name is Jame Gates.
Hi, I'm Jame Gates. We will not discuss the anthology that Patrick is talking about. My more current anthology, which also no intelligent person would take on, is War Stories, which is an anthology of newer speculative military fiction set in the near future. For the most part, there are a few farther future stories as well, but focused a little more on the personal side of the issue, the cultural, religious, psychological, and related ramifications of war. And that will be coming out soon from Apex. We actually just sent in the manuscript last week. So as long as they don't tell me to do anything more with Photoshop on the cover, that should come out soon without me destroying anything.
You know who's really great at Photoshop?
Who?
Me.
Don't offer.
Do you ever email me? No. Fine, be that way. And by the way, I may have been talking about Broken Time Blues. You don't know.
I know, Patrick.
Mm-hmm. And you were able to wrangle a bunch of great people here. So I'm going to go down the list and just call them off and let them introduce themselves, tell people who they are and what they do. Let's start with, well, you know what? I'm biased towards SF Signal, so I'm going to start with Karen Lord.
Okay. Well, I'm Karen Lord. Some of you may know my voice from the Crossing the Gulf podcast. But I also do write science fiction fantasy. I have been officer in training in the Barbados Regiment for a couple of years, and also an officer in training in Scotland while I was doing my master's. But on a slightly related but non-military side, I did the Foreign Service Program at Oxford.
Very cool. And you do have the SF Crossing the Gulf podcast with Karen Burnham. You guys have been doing that for quite a while now, and that's a great podcast. Eligible for Hugo, I might add. So,
well, yeah, I should say things like that, shouldn't I?
That's okay. That's what I'm here for. So
thank you so much.
And let's say hello next to Jack Campbell.
Hi, I'm Jack Campbell. And background is I was a career Navy officer. Did primarily ship driver. A lot of other things like intelligence. Right now, I'm a writer, and I've done a couple of series so far, the Stark's War series, the Sinclair / Jag in Space series, and right now I've got two going, the continuation of the Lost Fleet series. The 10th book of that 6-book series is coming out in May. That's Steadfast. And then in October, I'll be having the next of the tie-in series, Lost Star, is coming out. That's called Imperfect Sword. And also, Audible will be bringing out the first of a new series for me in sometime this fall. They're audiobooks only at this point. It's a series I call Steampunk with Dragons. And the first of those will be Dragons of Dorcastle.
Very cool. And Jack, I have a question of etiquette for the Navy.
Sure.
If your friend is in the Navy and they serve and they bring you a hat that has the ship's name with the CVN on it, are you allowed to wear that?
Well, sure. It's a gift.
Okay.
It is, if somebody asks you if you've actually served on it, you have
then
to
you
be
say
honest.
No. Yeah, but, then you say know, no.
Yeah, you can wear it, sure.
Okay, yeah, because it says USS Enterprise. I mean, come on. Come on. I got to be able to wear it. Very cool. Okay. Let's see. I got three more here. Let's say hello to Jay Posey.
Hello. I'm Jay Posey. Like everybody else here, I'm an author also. Legends of the Duskwalker series from Angry Robot Books. The first book came out last year, titled 3. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic sci-fi. And book 2 of that is called Morningside Fall. That'll be out April 29th. Also have a short story in the War Stories anthology. And my day job is I work for Red Storm Entertainment, which is Tom Clancy's video game development company. So I spent about 9 years there working on mostly on the Ghost Recon franchise.
Woo!
Woo!
I love that game. I do.
So glad. Hooray.
It's a good game. So next up, let's say hello to Cameron Hurley.
Yeah, I'm the author of a book called God's War and the sequels, Infidel and Rapture. It's a military SF noir with bonus bug magic, and it was actually just nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke Award.
Congratulations.
Yeah, woo! Yeah, awesome. It was a shocking day. My academic background is actually in the history of resistance movements, particularly in Southern Africa, and I got my master's at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa. I also blog regularly at my website, CameronHurley.com, and I'm actually kind of best known for an essay that came out last year called We Have Always Fought, which was about the history of women involved in conflict and storytelling and narrative related to that.
Very cool.
Oh, I also have a new series coming out in August. The first one's called The Mirror Empire, and it's going to be out the 26th.
Well, congratulations on all that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
And last but certainly not least, we have Mr. Chuck Cannon.
My name, you'll find me mostly under Charles E. Gannon.
Okay.
But yep, Chuck Gannon here. And let's see, what my agent would kill me probably, or very near to, if I didn't say that right now, Fire with Fire is the book that's out from Bain. It is the first in a, I guess you could call it a sort of interstellar intrigue, hard science fiction piece. It is up for the Nebula and up for the Compton Crook Award. And the follow-on to that is Trial by Fire, which comes out in August and shows obviously a stellar imagination for title change. And some of the other things, I work in the Starfire series, which David Weber started, Ring of Fire with Eric Flint. I've also done things in the long, not quite lamented war world, Man Kazin Wars, Honorverse, things like that. My academic and professional background actually was that I was well, let's just put it like this. I was a multiple Fulbright. I was in England and Scotland and a bunch of other places working on a book that in 2006 got the ALA Choice Award. It was called Rumors of War and Infernal Machines. I will not give you the full title that follows after the colon. Every single academic tech that's boring has one. And that's, I think, probably what's most worth saying, except for while I don't have military experience, personally, my family is actually of that generation of World War II where all of the sons served and all came back with their stories. And that's actually something that those stories probably influenced me as much or more as the sort of different shape that service has taken now, I would say. And, you know, once we have a volunteer service.
And I want to throw it out there for you. Do you prefer Chuck? If we're just talking casually?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Chuck, I just want to throw it out there. You know, publicists, like editors of anthologies, they're just all bark. There's no bite. Right, Jame?
You're adorable. There's plenty of bite with this one. But actually, Chuck, you actually provided the perfect launch point. One of the things that I wanted to ask is, science fiction and the military have gone hand in hand for a long time. A lot of the kind of household names and household titles have to do with conflict on either a small or a large scale. I have a lot of science fiction authors who are the better known ones, you know, have some element of that in their work. And at the same time, military science fiction sometimes gets kind of a bad rap in the industry. So why is conflict such a central part of science fiction? And, you know, how is it that military science fiction sometimes gets splintered off into its own little corner if it is a part of the overarching world of science fiction to such a degree? And I'll let Patrick figure out who gets to talk about that first.
Well, we're going to go in reverse order. So let's start with Cameron.
Actually, you know, it's really interesting. Chuck had said that about World War II and knowing a bunch of folks who served. I think the simple answer is, you know, why do we write military science fiction? Why do we keep going back to conflict? It's because it touches every part of our lives. I know for me growing up, my grandmother was actually a war bride. I mean, she came over from, you know, Nazi-occupied France with my grandfather. My father grew up there, and they came back with these incredible stories, right, where if something happened to a German soldier, 100 people were shot in my grandmother's village. You know, she was shot at by planes. There were some incredible, you know, stories of the French resistance. You know, her father was in the French resistance, and the Nazi soldiers, you know, the SS came into the house one day and was trying to figure out if they were listening to the BBC on the sly. And you start these stories of war, even if you have not served in conflict, these stories of war infuse our lives. I mean, especially now as well. I think the United States has been, you know, at constant war. And especially these last 10 years, it's been really difficult to turn on your television without seeing just how much that stuff uses us. So I think that everything is, in fiction is we want to explore how we feel the world around us. And that's really, I think, the first place that we go is to our writing as authors, as storytellers.
Chuck, what do you think?
Which is probably just riffing on Cameron. I think it has a tendency probably for a couple of reasons, but one of them is that, first of all, just as a fiction device or any sort of dramatic device, I mean, it's sort of the ultimate commitment, if you will, of stakes and costs. What are you willing to do to get what or to protect what, as the case may be? I think also it probably has a strong affinity for science fiction because there's a probably since about the latter quarter, particularly of the 19th century, and I will not bore anybody with with all the stories having to do with this, but coming up out of the War Office in Edwardian England and even late Victorian England, there's a growing sense of the fact that technology and war are part of a cycle in terms of impacting each other. And the imaginations of one will tend to influence the imaginations of another in a kind of feedback loop that, you know, trying to say, where do you get into it? That's a real chicken and an egg sort of thing. So I think that drives a bunch of it.
Jay?
Yeah, I'm just nodding my head there along with Chuck. I think, you know, it's especially in a large scale conflict, it's hard for people to remain untouched by war. Whether they're serving or not, you know somebody who's serving or your family's serving, whatever it is. And so a lot of times with a large-scale conflict, you have a lot of opportunities to tell stories from different points of view. But especially with military sci-fi, you know, you start to look at the nature of war and the human cost. And then as, I think as Chuck was saying there, you know, technology and the implications of how that technology is going to be used. You know, so it doesn't take long for people to think about, oh, robots are cool. Oh, what about robot soldiers? You know, and so I think there's, since science fiction, you know, great science fiction is always exploring ideas and then how those ideas impact actual human life and human ethics and those sorts of things. So I think it's sort of a natural crossing point when you look at war, which, you know, pretty much is the history of mankind is involved in war in some, you know, some respect. And then you add that to all the great ideas that technology can bring, and there's a lot of overlap there to kind of explore.
Sure. Karen?
I'm definitely agreeing with a lot of what's said here. I'm picking up two main themes. One is that in any kind of world building, when you have different peoples or worlds or cultures, and the question of conflict, whether it's on the level of war or something just below it, that is a marvelous part of plot, to be able to actually illuminate who these peoples are and what's important to them. And how they're what they're willing to do to preserve their way of life, but then the other aspect, which I do find fascinating, is that as they say, you know, the technology. When you have not only an invented technology, but different environments like zero G, like having to figure out how to wage war with the question of communications at stellar distances and so forth, you begin to invent strategy, invent tactics. And there's a level of fascination I find with that, because you're talking about sort of another element of science fiction.
Very cool. Jack?
I think, I definitely agree with everyone else. I mean, James asked at the beginning, why is there so much war and conflict in science fiction? It's so, sort of like asking, why is there so much war and conflict in history? You know, that's what people do, unfortunately. And if you projected a future history science fiction where there wasn't conflict, I think that would take a lot of explanation. What's changed in human beings that they wouldn't be doing what they've been doing for so long? So I think it's just a reflection of the fact that we expect humans to remain fundamentally human, and an aspect of humanity is that we fight over things.
Well, and I think it's funny that you say that, because a lot of people, the whole premise for them of Star Trek was the, you know, this peaceful future where humankind has settled and everything's fine on our planet. And so then what we do is we go out and we find other people to fight.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it, yeah. But I also wanted to say that I think one of the fascinating things science fiction can do is to not only look at the different technologies and the different battlefields, places you employ them, the new things, but also measure them against what I think are sort of the eternal things of the military and combat, the things that have been true on every battlefield and in every army, and reflecting how those continue on up through history, as they have through the past, and how they will integrate with the new systems and produce a slightly different military, but still, it'll still be a military.
Mm-hmm. Jame?
Once again, a nice springboard provided. Technology has changed the specifics and the details and the scale of war a lot. How is that influenced by science fiction, and how does science fiction influence the way that war is fought and the technology that is used? You know, the subject of robots was brought up. There's actually a huge proponent or huge element in the military, specifically in the infantry side of things, that is not at all sold on the idea of more robots, more drones, more automated war. One of the stories in war, actually a couple of the stories in war stories, deal with the problems of having AI fight our wars for us. So how do science fiction and war influence each other in positive ways? And what are some of the negatives that we might see, either that have already happened or going forward?
All right, we're going to change it up. Jay, what do you think?
Oh, man, I didn't want to have to lead off. but it's a great question. I think there's a lot you can unpack there. But, you know, it's to me, there's always an interesting space to discuss what's possible versus what's ethical, right? And you look at in the creative world, when you're just kind of making your own rules and playing around with things, you can kind of dream and say, oh, well, you know, what would it be like if I had an invisibility suit? You know, and there's a story that, it's kind of hard to know if it's true or not, but there's a rumor that there was a general who saw the movie Predator and saw, you know, the Predator suit and was just like, we need one of those, and went and talked to DARPA, and DARPA starts working on, you know, stuff. And it actually showed up in the latest Ghost Recon game that we worked on, this invisibility cloak that, you know, people are claiming is, you know, 5 to 10 years out from being useful. So
damn, if only he'd seen An Inconvenient Truth.
I know. So there are a lot of I think it does inspire things back and forth, and sometimes people get a little ahead of themselves and forget that, you know, certain things cannot be uninvented once they've been created, right? And that's, you know, go back to the atom bomb, and everyone's racing to get there first, and then we got there, and we were like, oh, maybe none of us should have gotten there. So I think that's another useful place for creatives. And, you know, when you're working on a novel or a short story, if you're really digging down into the humanity of it and you're trying to be thoughtful, I think a lot of times you can explore some of those boundaries before we actually get to where we have crossed them. And kind of discover some ideas about, at least create conversations about, you know, whether we should let AIs fight our wars for us and what that would look like. So,
gotcha. Karen?
I was just going to say, when you mentioned nuclear war especially, science fiction does give us the cautionary tale, you know, the sort of the nuclear winter post-apocalyptic tale is always cropping up. So at the same time that it gives us hints for technology that can be developed, it's very much an arena for us to really examine what the full consequences of using that technology could be. So you do get a bit of it hand in hand. And you can get a fair amount of hand waving. I mean, there's definitely stuff that you have in speculative fiction that is not possible to take seriously because you really are more examining the psychological implications rather than staying true to technology that works. But I think you should need to pay close attention to that as well because what was it that was said earlier? We're still dealing with human beings. We're still dealing with certain elements of the military that don't change that much. So killing at a distance can still be an issue, whether it's a question of you're holding a rifle or you're pressing a button. It's a matter of scale. And your story allows you to explore that.
Very cool. Jack?
Well, I've as far as fighting with robots go, I've got a basic rule, a law of AIs, which is that if you've got an AI that can operate not on its own, but it requires some kind of tether, some kind of control system, you can't trust it enough in combat because that offers a vulnerability. And the enemy can figure out how to exploit that, break into it, create all kinds of problems. So you can't trust it enough if it's got an umbilical. On the other hand, if it is capable of operating totally on its own, choosing its own targets, etc., then you can't trust it at all. Because these things are basically, they're computers. They're just like these little laptops we're playing with, except more complicated, so there's more things that can go wrong, more glitches. And they're quite capable of doing something supremely stupid and thinking it's absolutely right. So I think that may turn out to be something of a dead end in terms of practicality, unless there is a fundamental shift in how these things work. The human being, for all its flaws, is simply a heck of a lot more reliable than any AI that's ever been produced.
Well, you've never met my brother, so.
Yeah, well, I've met a lot. Let's see, what was the other point? Oh, you talked about, obviously, science fiction has inspired an awful lot of military things. I mean, my first ship, the USS Spruance, had a combat information center, which was clearly modeled on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise.
Woo-hoo.
Absolutely no doubt of that. But as far as negatives, what I'm seeing, particularly in the last decade or so, is people who think that if you see it or read about it in science fiction, that, hey, let's go build it. And we've spent God knows how much money chasing things that are far beyond the actual technology right now.
Yes, because I still don't have my jetpack.
You don't have your jetpack. We don't have the powered armor. Simple things like the power packs, power sources for this stuff. You're going to require some revolutionary advances in technology. So it encourages a syndrome of we can build this super technological thing that's going to solve all our problems. And it works great in the simulations, but when you actually try to build the sucker, you end up with something that's 20 years overdue, $20 billion over cost, and eventually they have to scrap it because it didn't work. And that's, I think, a real danger of science fiction.
Gotcha. Chuck?
I got to hit this from a couple of different angles. First of all, I think there are different conversations, so to speak, or domains of discourse, if you will, that science fiction and authorship has with the military and vice versa, because it's not like the military, which we've been talking about almost as kind of a monolith, really has a bunch of different domains in it. And I'm thinking, and I mean, you can subdivide these even more, but the perspective of the person in whose experience is active service versus procurement versus R&D versus staff is you know, it's going to be very different. And you know, to go back on how much interconnection there has been and kind of the way these domains of discourse overlap, when I was doing research for the nonfiction book that I remarked, one of my friends and somebody I'd done some consulting for early on was connected with, I guess you'd now call it McBoeing, McDonnell Douglas in those days, and he was able to give me a slide, because in those days I think they still use slides. It was not PowerPoint yet, of a presentation to at the Pentagon regarding the size of the B-1 bomber. And it started out in relation to the B-52 and then to the B-2, which was anticipated online, and then the first and then the first of the Starship Enterprises, and then the second of the Starship Enterprises. And the most interesting thing about this was no one in this room full of top brass thought this was inappropriate. As a matter of fact, afterwards they came up and they said, "Hey, that was a pretty cool idea." So the notion that these domains talk to each other and share a lot of common sort of iconography and language is really there, certainly at the very at the very highest level of these exchanges. Going on to some of what John was talking about, and John and I, on a couple of occasions now, on either science fiction panels, and I want to say even a couple of events where we were both doing some consulting via Sigma, very often are throwing, I think, cold water on the hopes, because when you're looking at a mediated environment, you see images and you say, "Oh, this has got to be possible because I'm seeing it right in front of my face," so to speak. Well, you're really not, of course, and AI is indeed a very tricky thing. And to just pick up something else that John mentioned, Jack, is energy density. I mean, so much of the stuff that they get very, very excited about, and they come to you very excited about, you sit there and you ask, "Yeah, but how are you going to provide the energy in a portable fashion, and how are you going to get rid of the heat, and this, that, and the other thing?" And these, for some reason, don't seem to be things that have been perhaps, they expect us, I think, very often to be the one saying, yeah, don't worry about that. And quite frankly, I think some of the most responsible work we can do is saying, "Well, no, you really ought to worry about that." And to talk just for 1 second about the practical use, I think it was the first thing I ever did with Sigma, we were brought in by the Battelle Corporation, and we didn't have to, I don't think there were no NDAs on this, and one of our members, Michael Swanwick came up with the notion of a mechanical mule. Now, certainly this had been out there before, and the notion that it would carry things for people. And very quickly, one of the things that came up the notion was, let's get back to the 70-pound pack, except for that. Everybody suddenly not so suddenly, but looked around the room and said, "No, that's not what would happen. The troops would figure out, oh, okay, well, the mule can carry this, that, and the other thing, and therefore we can load up with more of X, Y, and Z." And you wouldn't necessarily reduce the load, because there would still be the mule would become sort of a carry-all for the unit, and it wouldn't necessarily even achieve its tactical objectives just because of human nature.
Right. I know exactly what you're talking about. But I'm going to give Cameron the last word on this.
You know, there's a really, continuing on the Star Trek references, there's a really interesting Star Trek episode in the original season. It's about this planet with these two countries that have been at war for 500 years. Now, the way that they've managed to do that is that they virtually have a war. They basically kind of just send out, you know, fake signals to cities and say, "Okay, I just blasted your city. 2,000 people have died." What happens then is that the actual country that has supposedly been, you know, decimated by the other country then gasses those 2,000 people. That was how they were able to continue a conflict of that kind for over 500 years. The whole idea is that, of course, war is horrible. It's horrific. The reason it's horrible is so we'll actually stop. The reason we have to experience the horrors of war, folks say quite a lot, is so that we will eventually stop. And I think what's interesting to me, when I look at the sort of technology that we're putting into place, how we continually distance ourselves from kind of the horrors of the battlefield, what interests me is, what then happens to conflict? Are we going to be extending our conflicts? Are they going to become perpetual? Does it make it a lot easier for us to say, "Okay, well, let's send some drones"? So that's really kind of where I look at when I'm examining, you know, what technology does, the sorts of technologies that we're, investing in, and how that's going to change kind of the landscape of war and the psychology of war over time.
Now, before we go off onto something else, there's a couple of things there that I picked up on. One that I wanted to throw out there is, and you guys can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but what happens is war tends to drive technology in the real world. We have World War One, World War Two, and suddenly, you know, we've got cars rolling down the streets and all this other kind of technology just starts to hit, you know, first it's military and then it comes to the civilians. So there is something there, but you know, I for one don't want to, you know, push war to get a better cell phone. Does that make sense?
Well, it's interesting.
It's not the only thing that drives technology. Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah, it's not the only thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's a big thing.
Sure.
Well, it hasn't really been for the last 10 years, if you think about it.
Correct.
I mean, you look at, we spent God knows how much money on weapons development and technological advances in the last 10 years of war. And the frontline combat weapons we're still employing are things that were built in the 1980s and developed in the 70s. The advances that we assumed from World War One and World War Two just haven't been happening in the last 10 years.
Gotcha.
I would also argue that you know, the space race was actually a huge, and yeah, it's Cold War.
Yes.
But you know, getting to the stars, I think, drove an incredible amount of technology.
I would totally agree with that. That's mm-hmm. a very good point.
I think also, just to toss something in, is that the difference of the war, I think, since the closure of the Cold War, is a very different kind of war, not to mm-hmm. which is almost borrowing, I think, a Star Trek title or something. In World War One and World War Two, you had these conflicts which were, you know, if you want to call them, they were massive empires, whether or not they build themselves as empires or super states in conflict. And as a result, there were huge amounts of monies being thrown around. There were, you know, very sort of clear agendas that, while there was an awful lot of political debate about it, you know, the notion of the scale of commitment once the power was in was usually very, very high. What I find very interesting, when you get out of the polarized superstate wars that really faded, you know, when we came to the end of the Cold War, now you've got a situation where these sort of, you know, it's interesting to watch what has happened to both space and military and other funding in terms of big science and big technology and turning big science into big technology. The commitment is arguably not there. It's harder to move against other, you know, other economic objectives. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that when you're fighting a big state, you make big commitments,
mm-hmm.
and it seems like that sort of thing is not as much a driver right now.
What were you saying, Karen?
I was saying the stakes are higher.
Yes.
And that makes a difference. You're willing to take certain risks that you wouldn't do if you were just looking at things purely from an ordinary, everyday economic point of view.
Absolutely.
Yeah, look, we have spent an awful lot of money. I mean, the F-35 is going to be the most expensive weapon system in history.
Oh, man.
We've been putting a lot of money into development of weaponry. Arguably, that's being driven by other factors than threat. Mm. But we're still spending money on it.
The plan that you're talking about, is that the one that they ended up having like issues with and had to send back, and then it comes back again? And
oh, it's still got issues.
Yeah.
I have a quick question there. Is privatization of military technology becoming an issue with that?
How do you mean?
In the sense of if you have private suppliers of certain things, I mean, some of the research and development was very much government-based before.
So you're talking about like Boeing and the different companies here in Colorado that are doing a lot of the military stuff?
Halliburton, that kind of, yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, but it may be just we're asking too much or expecting too much. I mean, you look at the F-22, which has been fielded for a long time. The only place it's ever flown a combat mission is on a movie screen, thanks to special effects. It has this bad problem of stealing oxygen from its pilots, and we have no idea why it's doing that. And not too long ago, they found out that it steals oxygen from ground crewmen working on it on the ground.
Crap, so, we developed AI.
Yeah, it's
wait, that has a weapons potential that wasn't really anticipated. Doesn't it?
Are we sure these aren't Decepticons?
Yeah.
it was bad enough that the Secretary of Defense ordered the Air Force to go to the Navy for help with the problem.
I think, you know, going back to Karen's point, you know, asking about privatization, what suddenly sparked to mind is one of the things every time I look at the the F-35 right now, and I think now they're having to do massive redesigns on the next generation of carrier, if I'm not mistaken, because of things they're not sure about with the F-35. You get into this situation of too big to fail that we saw in terms of, you know, companies in during the most recent, you know, recession that wasn't quite a depression. And you get the sense with something like F-35 that it's both monetarily in terms of all the jobs and contracts that might be lost, the anticipated sales down the line, and you know, all the pork barrel that goes along with that. Have we gotten ourselves into a situation where there are just these projects out there that are, quote, too big to fail?
Because it's as much a risk to stop doing a project as it is to start it and commit to a human.
Right.
Well, yeah, you look at when they closed down the space program, you know, the space shuttle program, which when you talk about technology, and this is one of the other things I want to talk about, but the space shuttle sitting here, you know, 20 years later still had the same innards, essentially, the same electronics. You know, there had been no progress on that. But when that whole system shut down, look at all the people who lost their jobs or got shifted around. And I mean, it was almost cataclysmic for NASA.
Don't get me started.
but before we go down that road, there's another thing that you guys mentioned. You were talking about technology and you were talking about energy. And I remember seeing something. So does everybody here know Moore's Law?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so for the benefit of the listeners who haven't gone to Wikipedia yet, this basically is talking about how, what is it? Is it transistors and integrated circuits? Double in their capacity every 2 years or like every 18 months. So they keep getting smaller and smaller, the transistors and the microchips. The problem is, I remember seeing something, and it may have been like Mikio Kaku or something talking about this, but there was like a graph and it showed Moore's Law and it showed how the technology was changing year to year to year, and how the cell phones kept getting smaller and the computers kept getting, you know, more power, and they could do all this stuff. But energy sources pretty much flatlined. We don't have the new energy sources, and that's what Jack was talking about, and I believe Chuck, you know, we don't have the energy sources, the batteries. They're not, you know, we can't power the armor. We can't power the cool stuff that we want.
You know, interestingly, that was a question that came up with a project I was working on a while back. I have a friend who is basically the epitome of the mad genius, and we were talking about doing a new sort of work system, computer sort of thing that would be an entirely new hardware. And we were talking about the battery potentials for use in field work, specifically for the military. But there's actually something that came out fairly recently, and it's still such a prototype that it's going to be a while until it can be used. But they're coming up with some extremely small and even paint-on solar options now, which, given how much of our current military focus is on the Middle East, actually has some potential. So we're starting to see some progress there, I think, just because there's such a big rift in things. But it'll be really interesting to see, you know, where that goes and what that comes up with.
Yeah, there was actually an article, I was trying to remember where it was, but it just showed up in the last week or so, about U.S. Naval Research Lab trying to basically beam solar power from space. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but putting up a big, basically this huge, you know, solar power satellite, and then using radio waves to beam power to ships and things. So I think this is one of the you know, lessons learned from a decade of war in you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, is batteries are heavy, and you know, our guys are running around out there with, you know, 20, 30 pounds of batteries for radios and everything they have to carry. So it's kind of one of those things where I think, because we're at a point in, you know, technology reached a point where we've got, you know, GPS, and you've got all these radios, and you've got laser designators or whatever, our guys are carrying so much tech that they finally realized, we've got too many batteries. You know, we're spending all this money on batteries. We have to find another way to do this. And that, in previous conflicts, maybe we didn't have so much tech on our individual guys that nobody realized that there was a sort of upper limit that they were starting to reach. And now that we've kind of gotten there, and the amount of, you know, gear that people are carrying, now people are starting to think, oh, maybe there's a different way to go about this. So
Well, they definitely need they definitely need different power options.
Yeah,
well, it's a source of a great potential story too, because what's happening is it's the it has all the benefits, but also all the risks of a change in what you might call a logistic paradigm, which is, and to go back to what Jane was saying, I think that there's going to be some real, it looks like there's some real breakthroughs already in an awful lot of low power, local electricity generating options seem to be popping up. When you get to the higher intensity stuff, which is what's really interesting about that satellite, you know, essentially microwave, which goes all the way back to the SolSat stuff, really, of the late 70s, methodology different, but the principle the same, is, boy, doesn't that shift the focus of war both in space and on the ground? You know, because you get into that situation. So if one side is carrying batteries, but the other side is relying on essentially beam down power, what happens, therefore, in terms of how important orbital control is in the area of whatever satellite is beaming it down?
Yep.
Because you can turn one side off. Even if, you know, right now we're worrying about EMPs. Now you have another way of worrying about it. I'm not saying pro or con. I'm saying this is what we do, right, as military science fiction writers. This is exactly the sort of question we ask.
I just flashed on these big guys going, no, they have mirrors.
Well, you know, one of the things that this brings out, the power and the Moore's Law and everything, is there's a regular assumption that advancement, technological advancement, happens uniformly, that everything's advancing at pretty much the same rate. And that's not how it actually works. You know, you use Moore's Law as an example. Yeah, processor speed has been roughly doubling every 18 months, but I don't think anybody's going to suggest that software efficiency has been doubling every 18 months. Arguably, software efficiency has been moving in the other direction because we've had these humongous processors and RAM where we can make just about anything run, no matter how clunky it is.
Jay, get him.
Totally right.
So, it's an important thing to take into account that just because you're suddenly capable of doing this in one area doesn't mean that's going to translate into a tidal wave of changes in all the other areas. Sometimes there's very asymmetric advances in science and in practical technology.
And I was just going to say, on the flip side of that, you find these things that sometimes once there's a breakthrough in one area, you get all of a sudden this incredible rubber banding effect of like, oh, we figured out this power problem. Now look at all the stuff that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's all interconnected.
All connected, absolutely. And now we talk a little bit, and James, I don't know if you have a different way you want to go here, but I was just thinking, we've been talking about military, the actual military inspiring some of the science fiction stuff, but I think it's also interesting when science fiction inspires the military. So you guys keep going back to Star Trek, you know, cell phones, tablet computers, all this kind of stuff kind of came from science fiction and Star Trek, and then now we actually have them. Do you see anything in your stories, in your books, that you would love to have like hit the streets next week? I'll start with Cameron.
I'm probably the wrong person to ask that question to because my entire technology system is based on insects. And that's a far future one there.
Thank God for that.
I know, for a lot of people. And that was actually inspired by a lot of stuff that I was reading regarding, of course, you know, yeah, there's nanotech and throw a camera on a bug, but also that people were starting to train hornets to actually sniff out explosives. And I thought, wow, how interesting. What else can we use them to do? What else can we, set them to work doing? So for me, my stuff is so far future that I'm glad I'm not going to live to see it. So I'll pass that baton.
But is that what happened to all the bees?
Yeah, right. Like, or they're evolving into something else, and maybe we're recreating them into some horrifying thing that overtakes the world, like Planet of the Apes. I don't know.
Wow.
Should write a book about it.
Jay, what about you?
I'm actually probably a bad example too. it's funny, the sort of post. Well, I half jokingly call it a post apocalyptic tale, but for most of my novels. It's more of the cautionary tale of let's think about how embedded we're letting technology become, and so I did a lot of thinking about security and privacy and things like that, even before all the NSA revelations came out. So, you know, so for me, I think I was looking at a lot of, you know, what we're opening ourselves up to for convenience, you know, just because we can these days, because it's so easy to carry this, you know, tracking device around in my pocket, you know, that's recording everything that I do. It's called a cell phone, but it can do all these other things. So I'm kind of in that group. I'm not quite tinfoil hat material, but I do think a lot about, you know, how technology infuses our lives and sort of the ethics behind what we do with those sorts of things. So,
yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think all that is just BS. And I, for one, would like to welcome our NSA overlords who might be listening to us right now.
Yes, welcome. I figure working for the company that I do and all the research I've had to do for you know, Tom Clancy type things, I'm probably on every watch list everywhere already. So it's okay.
Karen, what about you?
Well, I'm not going to say I'm a bad example, though I am. What I am going to say is that what I've tried to put into the best of all possible worlds is not so much an emphasis on technology that we could go forward to, but an emphasis on a type of approach to technology, which is to say appropriate or intermediate technology. So the thing you'll notice by world building is that where you are changes what kind of technology you'll find. If you're in an urban area, you can expect certain types of things. But if you're, you know, out on the frontier, as it were, it is expected that you should be able to scale down what you have and what you can do with that. So I've actually created a culture and a world where people flit more easily between different varying levels of technology and are comfortable with that. I think I started very much disbelieving the kind of science fiction that is very monolithic and the level of technology you will see across the world, because that's not what we have right now.
Very cool. Jack?
Yeah.
Well, I've got, like most of the others, a lot of my tech is way out there. But there's two themes in my work which I think apply to here and now. Well, one of them is what the good part is what I call transparent technology, which is the idea that you should design systems so that the user doesn't have to think about using them. It just comes naturally. The example I give is a simplistic one in terms of loading a rifle, where a few hundred years ago, loading a rifle took many, many steps, and a lot of military training focused just on teaching them how to load a rifle. Now somebody pulls a trigger and a round loads, and they don't even have to think about it. It just happens. And I think if systems were designed that way, computer systems, everything else, where things just came naturally to people without them having to think about commands or odd thing ways of doing things, that it would greatly improve how effective they were. The negative thing is something that reflects what Jay referred to, concerned about the extent to which modern command and control systems allow a dangerous level of micromanagement, and that's only getting worse. Where people in the field will have people far from the battlefield sitting on their shoulder telling them what to do. And I wrote the series about that, the Stark's War series, over 15 years ago now. And I'm still getting emails from people in the field saying, yep, that's what it's like. So that's something I wrote as a cautionary thing, and hopefully somebody will pay attention.
That was a much better answer than mine, by the way.
Chuck, what about you?
So much of what I write, first of all, is hard SF, and it is set not close and not far. It's usually about 100 years in the future, and there's a bunch of reasons that I do it that way. One of them is because I find myself not going, let's put it like this, I will break the laws of nature, but only the rules that nature breaks itself. I will leave that apparently enigmatic comment undefined, because that's a whole thing itself. But one of the things that I like doing is taking a look at the technologies that are not imminent but envisionable, and how they might change our, you know, for good, for bad, predominantly in a conflict sort of environment. And at the same time, taking a look at the fact that to go back to John's point about technology does not progress in a uniform fashion, a factor. Going back to that same Battelle I guess you could say think tank or Blue Sky event that I was at. One of the things that I was looking at was they were looking at different small arms, and one of the things that popped up is that no matter how good the idea might be, there's the issue of in a sort of break period, one of the guys I think from Fabrique Nationale said it's not a matter of can you, but you know, the issue is do you wanna or do you have to. If it's a do you wanna, then the issue becomes, yeah, but how much investment do you already have in the standing systems? When it becomes do you have to, then all of a sudden technology, which may have been around in one nascent form or another for quite a long time, suddenly moves under the spotlight. And to, just for a really quick example, to go back to something Karen said, for instance, about what does zero-G put on you? Well, one of the things zero-G puts on you is control. In terms of controlling attitude shift when you're, let's say, discharging a firearm. And there may be some ways to deal with that. But, of course, no one is going to look at that until that do you want it, until that wanna becomes a have to. And that's one of the things that I look at, how that sort of – there is that disjuncture between, yeah, this has been laying around for a while, but no one felt a need for it.
Okay, Jame, we got time for one more round robin, and then we gotta start wrapping this up.
So one of the things that I actually really wanted to talk about, and what Karen and I talked about a little bit when I first invited her, is the more, I want to say, cultural and psychological side of war and the recovery specifically. We're starting to hear more about that side of things. I got a chance to do an interview a couple months ago now with a group up in Raleigh called Ranger Up. And I was interviewing the owner, who is a former ranger from the Kosovo area. And he was talking about, you know, the perception of special operations and special forces is that they go in and they kill things. And he's like, you know, a lot of what we were doing was providing security for the town mayor's daughter's wedding, or putting a roof on an old lady's house, or restoring power. And it's like, you know, we're doing all of these things that we're completely having to learn as we go, but they're about building the community and developing, you know, trust and all of those kinds of things. And that's a side of war that for a long time has kind of been neglected in science fiction and fantasy, although Star Trek has had its moments where it addressed it really well. So what I want to know from our rather diverse cast of authors and styles is, do you use that in your books? And if so, you know, what is the kind of stuff that we can really learn from it, and the examples that we can set that maybe will inform our policies going forward and shift from conquest to rebuilding, especially now that we're starting to do that more in the Middle East?
And let's start with Karen, since you two discussed that.
Okay. Well, it's true that the actual conflict can be more dramatic or more sexy, if you want to say, than the conflict resolution and the slow building. And I don't have any simple answers for that. I mean, we talked about how military SF is its own kind of niche in a way. And I've written a book which is about building after a crisis, and nobody would classify that as military SF. But in a way, coming out of war, coming out of disaster, the kind of things you have to do, not just in terms of infrastructure, but in terms of, as you say, community building, cultural strengthening, are very key, because you don't just kind of have a medal ceremony and then you've just won and that's the end of it. One of the reasons that I liked, to be quite random but still relevant, one of the reasons I liked The Lord of the Rings as much as I did is that when you got to the end, he spent so much time talking about trauma that everybody still carried. So when you had, Frodo talking about the anniversary of this wound, the next wound, when he talked about the rebuilding of the Shire and so forth, this was this kind of stuff that you, some authors don't spend enough time on, but it's never quite as dramatic. So it's not easy for some people to do that. And there's some readers who will never find that as attractive. So I don't know. I put that out there as a challenge. I mean, which is easier for you to do?
Cameron.
On the spot. You know, this is actually a really interesting question, because it's something that my first three books actually really explored was this whole idea of what do you do after the war is over when all you know how to do is fight a war. And that, I think, is not something I could easily sum up in a few sentences, which is why I write books about it. Because, I mean, I'm actually really fascinated. I would be fascinated to read books actually set in Japan, right, after World War II, and some of the ways that, you know, you go into a country and you say, okay, well, we've won. We still want you to be autonomous, but we're in charge. And actually, the first book that came to mind when you actually brought this up was, I thought, in a horrifying way, was Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, which is about a civilization that goes in and colonizes people and says, okay, now you're all citizens. Once you've proved your citizenship, then you become part of us. And all the little things that they do, right, to try to rebuild after these, they basically kind of decimate, whole populations. And okay, how do we then bring them into our fold so that they are citizens with us as well? And it's a horrifying assimilation, right? The Borg, they really are the Borg. Yeah. It's great. But it's really interesting the way that she does it. And it's completely creepy, but it explores that process of, okay, now how do we rebuild after we have, hurt all these people? And it's another one. I actually have three more books after the God's War books that I want to do that are 25 years after the war is over to, again, explore those ways of when I'm done fighting you, who are you to me? And how do we get along? And how do our children get along? Because they're incredibly interesting topics.
We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own.
Exactly. And they do. They collect like war relics of their like gods. And anyway, Ancillary Justice is awesome. Everyone should read it.
I've heard that from many different people. Yes. Chuck, what do you think?
It's not something that I've done in the early part of the series that that I started with Fire with Fire. But the threads are there for things that will occur later on. And what I mean by that is I've become very interested in the, I guess you could say, the particular or distinctive sorts of problems or erosions or issues that arise from individuals who, for one reason or another, because of their skill set, are in a constant cascade of high-tempo operations. And we're seeing a lot of this, certainly with, no one, I think it's pretty safe to say that 25 years ago, if you talked about the reserves and what they meant, and then what they turned out to mean in terms of, providing a huge sort of, core strength of field operations, sustained field operations, where you have people coming back for multiple tours. There's a major issue there, and that's sort of the thing that I'm interested in mind as you go down the line.
Jack, did you want to tackle this subject real quick?
I did want to say that one thing I try to address in all my books is the question of then what. And it's amazing how many military planners, people doing strategy, do not think about that. I would be in meetings, strategic plans, everything, and people would lay out this main idea, and you'd say, then what? What happens after that? Mm-hmm. And they had no idea. So you see that in the real world. We go into Iraq, and you get the then what, and they don't know the answer. So by presenting simulations, situations where then what is specifically addressed, I'm hoping people will look at that and say, maybe we ought to think about this before we go into a battlefield. What happens after our brilliant concept, if it works? What happens if it doesn't work? So that's how I try to approach that.
Very cool. Jay.
Yeah, obviously so many other great answers, but one of the things that stuck with me, my granddad fought in World War II, and one of the roles he did was he was an MP for guarding POWs. And like most of that generation, he didn't really talk about his war experience too much. But one thing that always stuck with me was him talking about how the conversations he would have with these guys, through the fence, basically. So the prisoners he was guarding, and knowing that he had to deal with the human side of the enemy, and the difference between what that person meant when they were across a battlefield versus what it meant when they were, on the other side of the fence. it's just something that's really stuck with me about all conflict and combat, really, having such an intimate human connection and the ways that we psychologically have to distance ourselves, you know, a lot of times. And another thing that sticks with me is sort of the human cost of death by some of the most mundane things. You know, a lot of times, you know, combat seems super exciting when it's, you know, it's on the movie screen or it's in a book, but, you know, a lot of times it's very sterile. And obviously, not having served and never having been in combat, I'm not an authority on this and I don't pretend to be, but I've talked with a number of combat vets, just, you know, there's no such thing as sterile combat. I remember reading, I think it's Horse Soldiers, actually, is about one of the first group of guys that went into Afghanistan. I think it was ODA 575. They, if I remember the story right, I may be conflating a couple of things here. JTAC calling in a close air support and had to change it. The batteries in his GPS in the middle of combat, and didn't realize that when he changed the batteries out, that the GPS defaulted not to the location that he had marked, but to his own location, and he ended up calling it an airstrike on his own position.
Oh no!
Jeez.
And you know, to think about this incredible group of guys out there doing, you know, the hard work that they're doing, and for something as simple as a battery change on a device that somebody, you know, back in the States built and never thought that it would be a problem that this thing would default to its own location. Those sorts of things kind of constantly remind me of just the real, very real human cost to war and to conflict. And I think that, you know, you don't have to put that stuff into your work, but knowing that sort of thing goes on, I think gives it you can treat material, I think, with more dignity maybe than what you see sometimes, you know, in some of the lighter treatments of things.
But. Absolutely. Okay, well, Jame, is there anything else before we start doing final thoughts?
Not specific. Well, actually, I did want to say, going back to an earlier discussion about how closely intertwined the military and SF are, I don't know if anyone else has seen them, but the Air Force has been running a series of commercials about, you know, it's not science fiction, it's just the Air Force, showing all sorts of science fiction scenes. And it's just kind of like, at this point, they've overlapped so much, it's hilarious. But they're actually really interesting commercials, so if people haven't seen them, they're fun to see. But
well,
other than that, I mean...
And as people know... Jame, I live in Denver. I'm just a little bit north of Colorado Springs, where the Air Force has, you know, kept the Stargate under wraps for decades now.
I grew up with a conspiracy theory-minded family. There are too many tinfoil hats in my family. I avoid such things.
Yeah, I was down there last weekend. I swear I saw a Jaffa.
No comment. You sure you weren't looking in a mirror?
You can't see it right now, but I've got one eyebrow raised.
Uh-huh. But no, I mean... Well,
no, I was just going to say that, as I mentioned at Dragon Con, you know Stargate is science fiction because the Air Force is running the thing, and it works.
Hey! Fantasy joke. Oh.
I'm so glad you made that joke and not me, even though most of my friends and family are Army.
Yeah, the joke I've always heard is that the Air Force officer walks into the restroom and he sees a Marine standing at the urinal going to the bathroom. And as he's walking in, the Marine finishes, flushes, and starts to walk out. And the Air Force guy says, "Hey, Marine. You know, in the Air Force, they teach us to wash our hands after we go to the bathroom." And the Marine says, "Yeah, but in the Marines, they teach us not to piss on our hands."
Yeah.
Come on! Come on!
If you can edit this, right?
I would just like it to be noted that, you know, Patrick does live in Colorado.
I do.
If anyone is offended by the jokes,
I know
get
people.
Get in touch with me.
I know people.
Make my life easier.
I know people at the Air Force Academy. Come on. So let's do this. Let's do final thoughts. Jame, why don't you tell people again about the anthology and the website and all that good stuff for the anthology?
So War Stories Anthology is coming out from Apex, and it should be out probably in the next 3 months, being generous, really generous, with time for proofing and final contracts and printing and shipping.
Ooh, you're probably on Janet's list right now, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I am. I actually got some edits back from her today. But it's a collection that I'm really proud of. But what I'm most proud of is the fact that we got over 700,000 words in submissions for that anthology. I have never read that much in my life. And what was the most impressive was the sheer quality that we had to sort through. I mean, it was hard. There were so many of those stories that I probably could have done 5 volumes of that without any issues, or, you know, without having any drop in quality. So there's a lot of amazing fiction out there that hopefully we'll start seeing a lot of short stories hitting the market too from new authors, and, you know, adding to the really great military science fiction that we already have in play. And I would just like to encourage people, you know, to go out there and get to know the genre, find the different voices in it, because there's something out there for everyone with this genre. You know, it's a subgenre, but it still has as many different facets as science fiction does, and there are some absolutely incredible works out there.
And Jame, what's your Twitter?
I'm just at Jame Gates, and follow me at your own risk.
And you're still collecting the Hello Kitty stuff? You like people to send you those links?
Patrick, I've told you many times not to try and hide your fantasies under my name. Yeah, and that, if you could that, stop that part, sending
that,
me those.
That part's getting edited out. So let's go to final thoughts with Jack Campbell. Jack, tell people where they can find you online and if you have any other final thoughts.
Find me online. Website is jack-campbell.com. There's an excerpt from Steadfast on there right now, the first chapter, as well as the cover. And the cover of Steadfast actually shows something from the book. So very that's cool. A pretty remarkable thing.
Wow.
Final thoughts. I think it's a very, military SF is a very interesting field. It gives you a lot of things to play with. I think people who don't read it think it's just one thing, monolithic, but actually it's a huge number of things. And ultimately it's about people. So I think it's a great field.
Very cool. Karen Lord, why don't you tell folks where to find you online and any final thoughts that you might have. And also, I want to remind people that they have, as this podcast goes live, they still have time to nominate SF Crossing the Gulf for Hugo.
Thank you so much for that reminder. And that allows me to say, in fact, that I think my website is in a link in the sidebar.
Yes.
On SF Signal. So all I will say is on Twitter that I am at Karen_Lord. And then my Twitter profile has my website address. And then my website has my Tumblr. So it all just links up in a marvelous chain. And I have The Best of All Possible Worlds, which came out in hardback last year. It's now out in paperback. And its sequel is arriving later on this year, The Galaxy Game. And those are very much kind of after the fact rebuilding, sort of rejigging of relationships across the galaxy and so forth. So if you do like the slow burn kind of conflict resolution thing, that might be something to look at. Final thoughts? You know what I always say about science fiction? Genre is a funny word for me. Always broaden your mind. Always look to blur the boundaries and to mix things up a bit. And you'll find that you have a better picture. You find you have a richer story.
Very cool. Jay Posey, tell people where they can find you online. And if you want to whisper in my ear how I can get, you know, free games and stuff, that's fine too.
All right. You can email. No, I won't give you that address. You can find me online at jayposey.com, jayposey.com, where I blog not as frequently as I'm supposed to. But I spend a lot of time on Twitter. At my handle is at HiJayPosey. That's H-I, not H-I-G-H. So just like you're saying hi.
So you're not in Colorado. Okay.
Correct. Yes, I am not.
Or Washington State. Yeah.
Yes, correct. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, those are probably the best two places to find me wandering around. Second book in my Duskwalker trilogy is will be out April 29th, and got a short story in the War Stories anthology that I'm very excited about. Final thoughts for me, I guess. One thing that a lot of guys have gotten a chance to talk about is sort of the civilian-military divide, or the gap that's especially prevalent in the U.S. these days. And Cameron brought up a great point earlier about what killing from a distance means for war and for conflict. I think we're seeing a lot that gap between the civilians and military these days are further removing citizens from the consequence of war, and helping us to kind of start to think that maybe warriors are this extra special class of people that can handle these things and are different than us. And it makes it easy to distance ourselves from the responsibility of war, and also from the responsibility that we have for the aftermath of war. And so I hope that, going forward, that we as writers and we as creators can maybe help to close that gap and help inspire, civilians to find ways that they can continue to support, our men and women who've served, just that we can continue to get them, the help that they deserve and need. So,
very cool. Chuck.
Where you can find me is Charles E. Gannon, no spaces, .com. At Facebook, I'm under Chuck Gannon. You'll be able to find the link to the Facebook and the Twitter, which I don't really habituate that much, on the website. Basically, if I was going to plug a book right now, it would be Fire with Fire, which people have it's up for the Nebula, and it was described. Somebody asked me to describe it, and I said it was like the Bourne Conspiracy meets the 3 Days of the Condor, 100 years in the future. And they said, "Well, so what's the next one? Trial by Fire, like?" And I said, "Well, that's kind of like the Longest Day meets Torah, Torah, Torah." So things are moving into a far more definitively military bent, I guess, in the second in the series. My takeaway, if there was anything, it's hard to add to all the good ones that have been there yet. Just to go back for a second, though, to what I think it was Jay said about the cautionary nature of our genre, military science fiction, perhaps particularly. It's interesting to note that the nightmare you articulate is almost never the one you live, and that might be one of the large cautionary values of our genre.
And Cameron, final thoughts: Picard or Kirk?
Kirk all the way. Yeah.
New Kirk or old Kirk?
Old Kirk.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, no. I'm a traditionalist.
Not a fan of J.J. Trek.
J.J., again, he forgets the heart and soul, man. It's all about the people and the stories, not the explosions.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry, gotta go that one.
Anyway, final thoughts, anyway. Website.
You can find me at CameronHurley.com. That's Cameron with a K. And also on Twitter at Cameron Hurley. I'm pretty active on there. God's War is out now in the U.S. and the U.K. And my next book, The Mirror Empire, will be out August 26th from Angry Robot Books. Final thoughts, just really great group of folks to speak with. Thank you all for the invite.
I'm contractually obligated to go, Angry Robot.
Lee will send you a check.
Actually, the check goes to John and Elio. I never see a dime. He wrote the song. I'm the only one that sings it. But hey, so I want to thank everybody for coming on tonight. Jane, anything else before we go?
I don't think so.
All righty. Thanks, folks, for coming on. Really had a lot of fun. Appreciate you. And support our military. That's all I can say.
Yay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
It's great working with you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal Podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day. From weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah. Thinking and crap.
And scene.